Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. I'm very happy indeed to be here at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery once again, and being together with many familiar faces and a few new ones. As Ajahn Karunadhammo was saying, I have been coming about once every 2 years in the last little while, and that's the plan that we have to continue into the future, but of course the future is uncertain. That's the idea. So Lumpur Pasanno would come to England 1 year, and I would come to California another year, and we would just keep trading off until one of us falls off our perch. So we'll see what happens in that respect. One of the questions that came up in conversation today, with some people I was talking with earlier on, I thought might be a useful area to speak about in terms of some Dhamma reflections this evening. And this is how we relate to work and activity and things that we engage with in our life. So the things that we do, whether that's the livelihood we have, whether it's say making a journey, traveling from one place to another, whether it's sitting down to meditate, whether it's or engaging in a meditation retreat. It's very easy for us to make the things that we do into a chore or a burden or something that's stressful. And so it's, or like at tea time, people asking about, what do you think about retirement? Are you looking forward to retirement? And it's a very strong ethic in our society. It's the, thank God it's Friday. I'm looking forward to the weekend, or I'm really glad when I'll have my holiday, or I can't wait for the bell to ring. Yeah. I can't wait to get on the retreat. I can't wait for the retreat to be over. Probably a few of us have, even professional meditators have these feelings. So that, I feel that's something that's very useful to look at. And one of the things that I point out in this respect is how curious it is that the most peaceful moment of the meditation is when the bell rings. I'm not reading anybody's mind, but it's not just because our knees have been given relief from stress and discomfort, but when the bell rings, isn't it curious how something in the heart goes, ah, right? Thank goodness that's over. Even though the meditation is supposed to be when we're being peaceful, that's supposed to be the good bit, but it's mysterious how when the bell goes, there's a feeling of relief or release. And what I feel that points to is an important principle, which is that the feeling of me having to do something, me engaged in some task, even if the task is me meditating, that has a kind of stress to it. And so we relate to peace being that feeling of, oh, wouldn't it be nice when I don't have to bother, when I don't have to do this anymore. I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to not bother with this. So the very way that the mind phrases this, and again, I'm not reading anybody's mind, rest assured, I don't have those kind of abilities, but this is generally how we think. So that we look forward to that space over there when I don't have to bother with this. And that's attractive, that's appealing. But I would suggest that that kind of peace where I don't have to bother, or I don't have to deal with this. I don't have to be engaged in this activity, this work, or this this journey. That the quality of peace doesn't really come from when that activity or that work or that effort is over, but it's really to be found somewhere else. Because as most of us notice, you get to the end of one effort, and then you get to the weekend, and then the weekend can turn out to be more busy and active than the work week. How many people have retired and found themselves far more busy than they ever were when they were engaged in paid employment, right? It's the kind of thing that's said many, many times. So I feel that the important thing, the most useful thing to consider in this respect is, what is the attitude with which we work? If any kind of work or engagement is somehow stressful, and if peace only comes from when we're disengaged or switched off or not feeling, not doing, is that a peace that's really reliable? Is it dependable? Is it something that can be sustained? The instruction that we're often given in meditation is to let go, or to be practice non-attachment, be the witness of our mind states. And so again, we can relate to that flow of activity. I'm just watching. I'm just observing. I'm not really engaged here. I'm just being the one who knows. I'm being the observer, the silent witness. And many times in many meditation retreats or books of Dhamma teaching, it gives that kind of advice, and I've probably given it myself. it's very, very common. But what that, again, that, from in a slightly different way, that can encourage a quality of attitude whereby any kind of engagement, any kind of doing, is an intrusion on your peace. And if you really want to be awake, if you really want to practice non-attachment, then there's a kind of numbing or dissociating or a freezing. You don't do anything, as if any kind of doing or choosing or engaging was a disturbance of that quality of peace. Does that make sense? That familiar territory? So I have a little campaign against all of that. You could probably see that coming. a kind of ongoing effort to rejig the perception, because in a couple of different ways, when we look at, say, the Buddha's life as an example, if we have confidence in the Buddha's enlightenment, that sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, then he completely freed his heart from greed, hatred, and delusion. He's totally enlightened. How did he then choose to travel all around Northeast India? How did he have the creative imagination to give the thousands and thousands of Dhamma teachings with amazing illustrations and similes and the lists? You know, where did he come up with all those lists from? You know, if he was totally enlightened and his heart was completely, embodying the quality of peace, where did all that doing come from? How did he create the Sangha, the monastic order, the order of monks, the order of nuns, the lay community, you know, the 84,000 sections of Dhamma teachings in the Tipitaka? That's a lot of stuff. He traveled a lot of miles, he went to a lot of places, established a lot of monasteries, and it was so thoroughly done that it's still active 2,500 years later. That's a lot of doing, a lot of very creative and thoughtful and effective doing. So if we take his life as an example, how could all of that doing and creative activity and use of imagination and effort and engagement, how could that be an intrusion on his peace? How could that be something that was, you know, a burden or stressful? If we take the basic understanding that he was unable to experience dukkha, stress and suffering, how is it possible to be carrying out all of that work and all of that, say, the affective and imaginative engagement with society and for it to still be alive today? So the thing that makes a difference in my perception is not whether there's activity or inactivity, but the way the mind picks it up. And that if you look at the Buddha's teaching on right effort, Samma Vayamo, in the Eightfold Path, that gives us a clue. Anyway, it gives us a template for the Buddha's attitude towards this. So you have in this, not to get too technical, but he divided that right effort or the skillful effort into four different pieces. So there's firstly the effort to restrain unwholesome qualities from arising. And secondly, if unwholesome qualities have arisen, like greed or anger or fear aversion, to let it go. Then the third one is to cultivate the wholesome, loving kindness or wisdom, concentration, compassion, so forth. And then if wholesome qualities have arisen, to sustain them. So you have restraining, letting go, cultivating, maintaining. Those are the four aspects of right effort. So that looks like a lot of me doing something. I shouldn't have so much anger. I should stop that those angry feelings from arising. If I feel angry or I feel jealous or I feel afraid or lustful, I should let that go. I should have more loving kindness and compassion. I need more wisdom, and I need to keep this loving kindness going. Isn't that familiar? You know, haven't you probably sat here and heard me and others talk in these kind of ways? The way that the mind picks it up, our habit is to put it all in terms of self-view. I have got a habit of getting angry, or I have a jealousy problem, or I have a fear problem, or a restlessness problem. I need to get rid of that. So the I am, I have, I do kind of sneaks in the back door and takes that over. And that if right effort is really right, is really samma, really in tune with reality, then rather than that, the restraining of the unwholesome and the cultivating of the wholesome and so on, rather than that being me who's got this anger problem or this fear problem or this greed problem, that I need to get rid of that or to get more compassion or get more concentration, get jhanas or get insight. Instead, it's seen there is this unwholesome quality of anger or fear, and if that comes into being, then that causes disharmony in this life and disharmony in other people's lives and in the world. Therefore, let there be the effort for it to be restrained. There doesn't have to be an I or me or mine in there. If that feeling of anger or fear or jealousy and lust or restlessness, jealousy and so on, if that's arisen, rather than, oh, I'm feeling jealous, I should let go of this, here is jealousy. There's the awareness of this jealous feeling or this restless feeling or this averse feeling. This has arisen. It doesn't have to be called me or my jealousy problem or my experience of fear or I'm afraid. It's like, here is fear, it has arisen. Or let there be loving kindness rather than I need more loving kindness. Loving kindness is a wholesome quality. If this or that practice is followed, then it arises. And if that's followed, then that brings benefit to this being, to other beings, to the world. It's something that is conducive towards peace and clarity and skillful experiences, skillful qualities. So what this means is that those aspects of work can be fully exercised, can be actualized without any kind of self-view, without it being a me who's the doer. And that is what I would suggest is the thing that makes a difference. So if we can learn how to work and to engage and to guide these lives based on mindfulness and wisdom based on an attunement to the time, the place, the situation, then we can do a lot of work. We can go places. We can use our imagination. We can be very effective in functioning in society and in the workplace, in the family. And that, I would say, doesn't carry the same kind of stressfulness or the sense of burden when there is the feeling of I and me and mine. So that we'll have time for discussion and questions and answers at the end of the talk. So if you want to talk about that or disagree, then you're quite at liberty to. But I would suggest that's the aspect that makes all the difference. So that when we learn how to work in that way and to guide our actions based on that quality of mindful awareness, attunement to the time, the place, the situation. When it's not me dealing with my problems or me trying to get my spiritual qualities developed, but rather here is the awake mind seeing the way things are and responding effectively, then that engagement is peaceful in its activity. You don't have to get to the end of the walk and then sit down to be peaceful. You're peaceful as the body is walking. You don't have to wait till the work day ends. You don't have to wait till the Dhamma talk ends before you can be peaceful. But even as the talk is going on, as the journey is continuing, there's a quality of peace and ease and attunement right there. So if there's a recognition of this and steering the mind towards this quality of letting go of self-view and functioning from a place of selflessness, there's a radical effect upon the way we live our lives, the way that we can function in the world. We're not always looking for peace to be an absence of activity or an absence of noise or an absence of a responsibility, but rather, even as those things are present, there is peacefulness, there's an ease, there's a relaxation. So with respect to the meditation and this idea of non-attachment, or letting go, this other aspect is closely related, I would say, because what it can point to is I'm just watching. There's this feeling has arisen, or there's this sensation in the body. I'm just watching. And that people say, well, in the world, in our lives, you know, when we see injustice in society, or we see a conflict going on, if we practice non-attachment, are we supposed to just sort of sit back and do nothing, or kind of be neutral? Or in the meditation, that I'm just watching this feeling in the body, or I'm just watching this emotion in the mind. And even though one is sincerely trying to follow that instruction to practice non-attachment, or to let go, or to be the watcher, be the observer, what is often happening is that our natural responsivity is being unplugged, is kind of being deadened, so that we're creating a kind of false abstraction or dissociation, if those are not too long words. there's a kind of numbing, a kind of deadening of our innate responsivity, and that the intention is very sincere. The Ajahn told me I should just watch. Okay, I'll just watch. I'm practicing non-attachment. But your capacity to act is part of the way things are. So I'll say that again. So, yeah. Your capacity to act is not an intrusion on the way things are. It's part of the way things are. So like again, I was chatting earlier today with someone, and there's this line in one of T.S. Eliot's poems, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Do I dare disturb the universe? You know, that should I do something? Should I step in and intrude upon the universe? Should I disturb the universe? And I would say, wrong question. You know, you are the universe. This, and your capacity to act is the responsivity of the natural order. What part of your body and mind is not part of nature already? You know, that we might say, well, I'm just watching the way things are. I'm just being the observer. But the observer is also part of the way things are. Does that make sense? So rather than intentional action being some kind of disturbance or intrusion upon nature, that recognizing we are nature, we are the universe. This is a living natural system that every aspect of our body and mind and our heart is part of. How can it not be? Yeah, even things that are quote unquote fabricated or synthetic, you know, that you know, plastic is made from oil that's come out of the ground and has been put through refineries, probably in Richmond, and kind of fed through various machines and boop, you know, plastic. So even plastic is part of the natural order. So that the when we see that our capacity to act is also part of the way things are, then rather than the sort of just watching or just being the observer or practicing non-attachment, meaning that kind of freezing or dissociation or abstraction, like trying to turn yourself into a kind of CCTV camera. I'm just recording data here, you know, just observing the data of my life. Then I'm kind of exaggerating it, but we can't be like that. You know, I'm supposed to just observe, you know, arising, passing away, arising, passing away, arising, passing away. You know, and then you think, well, the hall is on fire, Ajahn. last year there was these huge fires that were encroaching right at the edges of the Abhayagiri forest. One of the novices was telling me he was the first one to spot it about 1:30 in the morning, and he's kind of running through the forest and get a wall of flames coming over the ridge. The appropriate thing to do is not to be sitting in your kuti going, heat arising, flames arising, smoke arising, sound of alarm horn arising, knocking at my door arising, passing away. It's like, get out of your kuti, you know, run. The forest is on fire, you know, leave now, you know. That's the appropriate thing to do, you know, so that. I'm kind of exaggerating it, but we can be like this. You know, that we can, well, I'm supposed to just observe arising and passing away, and you know, or as Ajahn Sumedho would often use as an example, someone says, we just heard that you know, your mother has passed away. Oh, well, all that arises passes away. You say, no, it's your mother just died. You know, it's not just another sankhara arising and passing away. That's something that's your heart, your life is connected to. And to think, well, I'm just supposed to be, I just observe, you know, all things, all conditions arise and pass away. That was my mother. You know? So that is a very crass or gross example of how you can take an idea or a theory and then mishandle it or misinterpret it. And even though we feel that we're doing the right thing or we feel that we're following the instructions as we should, we're kind of picking it up in a foolish way. So that when we recognize that the quality of intention the mind's awareness of the world, you know, they're one of the aspects of the Buddha nature, the Buddha mind, is that the Buddha is the knower of the world, the lokavidu. That's also the Buddha is the knower of the world, but also that mind is engaged with the world. Another of the Buddha's qualities is vijja charana sampanno. So the vijja means awareness or awakened knowing. Charana is conduct. So the Buddha isn't just the knower of the world. Also, that Buddha wisdom, that Buddha awareness, is manifested in conduct. That the vijja and charana, the awareness and the activity, they're two faces of the same quality, like the front and the back of the hand. that they go together. They're kind of two parts of the same whole. So when there is that quality of awakened awareness, then part of that is the responsivity of center of experience in relationship to the world, to what it sees. You know, flames coming over the ridge, right, act. Get out of your kuti and come to the kind of the meeting point, the fire meeting point. That's what you do. You hear that your mother's died. Yes, all sankharas arise and pass away, but this is your mother. So you step forward and engage with the family and with your own heart, with those feelings. So in this respect, one of the ways I like to talk about this is that the life that we have is part of a self-adjusting universe, that it adjusts itself, so that letting go, say, for example, in meditation, and you bring attention, you have a pain in your leg, and it's getting more and more intense, the teacher has said, you shouldn't, it's not a good idea to fidget and just be moving around as soon as you feel discomfort. It's good to be patient with the feeling of pain. Okay, I'll follow that advice and practice patience. But also part of that, that feeling of pain, is the awareness of the body's limitations. And at a certain point, there's the awareness of, well, this is painful feeling, but this joint now is apparently stressed to the degree that this it feels like real damage is about to be done. Therefore, knowing that, receiving that signal or getting that sense, yeah, that okay, that pain has been accepted. I'm not fighting against it. I'm not resenting it. I'm not hating it, but it's bringing the message: time to move. And so then, the practice of letting go or non-attachment doesn't mean, therefore, just stay with the painful feeling. It means let the body move. So that's just one familiar example. And so oftentimes when people say, well, what should I, you know, I'm in this terrible situation in my workplace, you know, that people are being really aggressive with each other, or someone is sort of helping themselves to the office supplies, you know, should I just practice non-attachment? You know, they're kind of carrying out all this thievery. Should I just let go? What's the Buddhist thing to do? Or what's the right thing to do? And with the idea that, oh, if I was practicing letting go or non-attachment, I would just let them carry on stealing all the office supplies. But perhaps that's not the wise thing to do or the appropriate thing to do. Perhaps the appropriate thing, the way of letting go, is to take action. You let go of your hesitancy. You let go of your kind of fear of being criticized or being disliked. And instead, there's a response, that natural responsivity is allowed to engage. So I could give many, many other examples, but I think you probably get the point. So this kind of process is what I call unentangled participating. So there's a lack of entanglement, the mind is not getting caught up in the complications of the world. It's unentangled, but it's also participating. It's that the mind is attuned to the world, it knows the world, but it's not entangled with the world. It's not caught up in the complications. It's not limited by the world. And so this is, I feel, one of the beautiful aspects of Buddhist practice and the Buddha's teaching. It points out how we can both fully attune the heart to the world, but also be unburdened by the world. We can attune our life to the lives of others and to the work that we can do, and the way we can help and be of benefit to ourselves and others, but without making that into a stressful duty or something that's an obstacle or a challenge or burdensome or stressful to us in any way. So to the thinking mind, it's it can be confusing. Well, do I care or do I not care? Does it matter or does it not matter? And the answer is, well, both. Like we were having the conversation at tea time today, that sense of, and I was recounting these two very short poems that arose in my mind when literally day one of Abhayagiri Monastery, 22 years ago or so. Was the first poem was, in the midst of everything, there is nothing. And then the second poem was, in the midst of nothing, there is everything. And in a way, it's like binary vision. When we have two eyes, then we can see three-dimensionally. So that one eye is like everything matters, the other eye is nothing matters. And that if we have both, rather than interfering with each other, having that binary vision helps the visual world, the eye, to see a three-dimensional picture. So it's spiritually, it's exactly the same. There's this quality of say, caring for the world that we experience, caring for the infinite number of living beings and the living world, and what we can do, the capacities that we have in the world, and then the other aspect is then not clinging, not grasping, not identifying with the world. So there's the vijja, there's the awareness, the quality of knowing and say clear seeing of the way things are, and then that clear seeing informs activity or the way that we work, the charana, the conduct, what we say, what we do, the choices that we make. And that with those two together, even though they might seem to be opposed, when they are balanced, then what we have is the middle way of three-dimensional vision. We have that mysterious middleness of being able to engage in with great effort and commitment and sincerity, but to not be bound or limited or burdened by that in any way. One of the last thing to add before we have time for some question and discussion and such like is the in a way to stress the quality of self-view and how this is the troublemaker. Self-view is the reliable troublemaker. And so it's so matter of fact to think in terms of self. I mean, I am Ajahn Amaro, this is Ajahn Kurundamo, it's Venerable Pesalo. Yeah. This we have names, this is my identity, this is Jennifer. Probably checking her phone.
My son. I'm engaging with my child.
So this we have a name. We have an identity. We have a kind of a social role. It's also kind of automatic. We say, oh, this is who I am. It's so ordinary and everyday. I am so many years old. This is my address. This is my nationality. This is my gender. This is my occupation. You know, this is my place of my birth, and so on and so forth. And that's so ordinary and everyday. But one of the great strengths of Buddhist teaching and Buddhist meditation is the insight into not-self. And so this is not the teaching on not-self, again, is easily misunderstood, as people can think, well, am I supposed to believe that I don't exist? I'm not really here, I don't have a self. But for most people, the most real thing in all of our lives is this experience of experiencing, right? That's the most real thing for all of us, is that we know we are feeling this life of ours. That's the most real thing for most people, that something certainly seems to be going on. But the teaching of not self is not about trying to believe that we don't exist or that we haven't got a self as a sort of metaphysical thing, but rather it's shifting the view from seeing in terms of I and me and mine, and to seeing in terms of nature. So that, yes, there is a body, and I say this is my body, but really the body belongs to nature. It's breathing all the time. Air is, oxygen is going in, carbon dioxide is going out. It's part of the living system. We eat food. We feel the force of gravity. We relate to other human beings. These are all parts of a natural process. So that we, when we say I or me or mine, that we're not trying to pretend that there is no experience of knowing, or that our life isn't happening, but rather we're shifting the way that those aspects of life are named and categorized. So rather than seeing in terms of self, of this individual independent entity, we're looking at this life as part of a natural order, that this is a part of an organic living system. So when we shift the view from self-centered, so that I've got an anger problem, I've got a fear problem, or I've got my mind is full of agitated thoughts, to shift the view that, well, the mind is capable of thinking, and here they are. The mind is capable of fear, it can experience anger, it can experience hope, and it can experience love, and here it is. These qualities are part of the natural order. They come into being, they take shape, they dissolve. They're not personal. When we have that first insight, and the Buddha's teaching on vipassana, insight meditation, aims right at this change of view, this change of ways of seeing, and it helps the mind to recognize, oh, I call it my thought, but really it's just like the sound in the street. It arises, it does its thing, it passes away. I say this is my body, but what's the thing that's doing the owning? You know, it's really just this. It has these qualities, and it does its thing. It has its forms, its feelings. It's part of nature. There isn't really a me that's definable or findable. It is the owner, and so that it's changing the view from a self-centered perspective to a nature-centered perspective. So the first level of that kind of identification is what you can say is the I am the body, I am the personality. And so the insight meditation, vipassana, is a powerful tool that helps the mind to be brought to that, to question that identification. You know, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm old, I'm young, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm a doctor, I'm a monk, I'm a layperson. All those I ams, and so that the letting go of self-view, the breakthrough of the heart to recognize these cannot be anything other than convenient fictions. That they can't have any solidity. That there's no way that they have any absolute and ultimate value. So like nationality, I use this as an example very often. So I was born in England, so I started out being British. Then I got American citizenship a few years ago. So now I'm American as well. So I have two nationalities. So where am I from? You know, which country do I belong to? Am I American or am I British? So, well, you're really British, Ajahn. But you know, my mother's father was German, and her and my mother's mother was Belgian. So I'm a quarter Belgian, a quarter German, and half English. But then where does the American come in? So what am I? You know? So the quality of nationality, or that people who immigrated into the U.S., that you know, you were German and you gave up your German passport, became American. Well, I was that, and now I'm this. It's a convenient designation. It's just a human agreement to say, okay, here is a document that says this person was born so many years ago, and this is their name, this is their number, this defines this particular entity. Boop. That's all. There's nothing solid or permanent there. So what we call sakaya ditti, or self-view, that's defining that insight. into that feeling of I'm the body, I'm the personality, this is who and what I am. So that when that is seen through, when that is fully understood and let go of, that's the first, the first level of realization, or the first sort of entry point into the path of liberation, what the Buddha called the first of the 10 fetters. And so that is, the heart finding its way towards enlightenment, towards full liberation. Another aspect of this, though, is that much further down the line, there's a more subtle quality of identification, that just the feeling of I-ness, me-ness, and my-ness that's not associated with being of a particular nationality or a gender or an age, or it's not associated with any personal qualities. So, and again, this is something that people experience in meditation, that when the mind is very, very quiet, very, very, very clear, very peaceful, there can be the sense of it's absolutely obvious that the body is not self, or that these stories that you remember, that these are not a person. They don't belong to a person. They're not a self. They don't belong to a self. The sensations, there isn't really an owner of these flow of sensations and perceptions. They're just arising and passing. So it can be really clear that the body, the personality, these stories, these are not who and what we are. But still there can be the sense of, yeah, but I'm experiencing, I'm meditating, I am reflecting on these thoughts being not self. There's an I feeling, but that I feeling is not associated with an age, a name, a family, a role. It's just the sense of an experiencer, a doer, a meditator, that there's an I feeling, I the knower, I the actor, I the one who's choosing, even though it's not connected to any particular thing. So that quality is called asmi-mana, or the conceit of I am. So that's a lot more subtle. So sometimes in meditation, this is where things can get stuck or limited, where that we're kind of trying to be the witness or be the one who knows, be the meditator. So that the Buddha pointed to this too as an obstacle that needs to be let go of. And in one particular teaching, he said, to be free of the conceit I am, to be free of asmimana, that is the greatest happiness, and that is nibbana. To be free of that is to realize nibbana here and now. To be free of that conceit of I am, so that in this exploration of self view and seeing how that's a troublemaker, to not just be looking at it at the level of the body, the personality, and those kind of the more kind of crunchy and colourful personal characteristics, but even that feeling of I-ness, the me-ness and my-ness, to bring the quality of wisdom and investigation to explore that and to let that go. So then there's not a me who's watching, or a me, an I who is the experiencer, or an I who's a knower, but there is knowing, there is experiencing, there is watching, there is that participating. But there is not a sense of I and me and mine that is the agent or the doer. And as the Buddha said, that is what brings the greatest quality of peacefulness. Now you might think, well, that sounds really spaced out. And that, that's really kind of off in the stratosphere. But if you go back to the Buddha's life as an example, then if he was free of that quality of mana, of conceit, how did he walk all over Bihar and Uttar Pradesh and give all those teachings and engage with all those people in such a creative and thoughtful way? So that letting go of self, it doesn't disable us or make us less functional. Or, you know, well, if I let go of self, Ajahn, how can I get to work? You know, or how do I talk to my family? You know, if I don't exist, you know, these qualities of self-view and conceit are really let go of, that doesn't make you less functional. It makes you more functional, more effective, and more able to act in skillful ways. So it's not like wisdom is a disabling condition. It is an enabling in the best possible way. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening, and I'm happy to open things up for conversation. So we have a little bit of time, it's about 9:15. I think we'll try to wind things up around 9:30-ish. So time for a few questions, if there are any in the room. Yes, please speak up.
Yes, I have a question. When I was listening to you talk, I was wondering if, and I'll use Buddhist terms, if you are another mother as an example, because I don't know any other people that could be able to do it, but if you have a certain job, and let's say you're at the point where you could just let everything go, would you be able to actually put on a business suit, let your hair grow out, and really be in the workforce and still be a monk inside?
Me, personally.
Well, you know what I mean. But like, can somebody actually do that, or is it better if you step out of that the entire environment and put yourself in a more holy environment? To be able to be more congruent with your eye.
I don't know if I remember how to tie a necktie. I haven't worn trousers in 40 years. So there would be a certain education process necessary. But it's a good question, a common question. I think those kind of things, it's up to individual preference. The Buddha established the monastic order, and the Buddha lived as a monk. He was completely incapable of suffering, but he did choose to walk barefoot around Bihar for 45 years as a wandering mendicant living on alms. So the choice of monastic lifestyle is a choice of simplicity and to learn to live in a way that you're living as lightly upon the earth as possible. If someone wishes to put themselves into a business suit, get the shoulders and the kind of look, they can do that. You know, and there are people who do quite consciously function in the business world or the academic world as a very consciously as a service, that they don't really feel like they're not invested in it in the role, but they relate to it as a kind of service, and they see that what they can bring to that domain is perhaps something very, very useful. So, for example, maybe not exactly what you were asking about, but I met with Bill Ford of Ford Motor Company a number of years ago. And at that point, he was considered a little bit too green and so liberal to be given anything dangerous to play with. So he was put in charge of the Ford Motor Company's charitable activities. But what happened was that he became so kind of appreciated and liked and trusted that they kept giving him sort of more and more important jobs until he became the CEO of Ford Motor Company. So anyway, when I met him, he asked me, and it was because he was interested in Ajahn Chah's Dhamma books, and he was very keen on Ajahn Chah's teaching, so I was invited to his home to chat with him. So his question was, well, I'm kind of a great grandson of Henry Ford, and I'm in this family, and you know, and I'm doing this job, but you know, and I'm married, and we have four kids, and what I really want to do is to kind of go off and live in the forest in Vermont, and you know, grow cabbages, and do you think that's a good idea? And so he was, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot, so. And so, me as a card-carrying spiritual type, I think he was expecting me to say, well, of course, go to the woods and live deliberately in the woods with you and let your kids run around barefoot in the forest and have a good time. But to my surprise, somewhat, I found myself saying, well, you could do that, but you're in a very powerful position. You're in this family, and from what I understand, you are well respected, and you have the name, and perhaps you can, within the scope of the Ford family and the Ford Motor Company, you can bring things into the company and the way the company operates that wouldn't come from anybody else. And he didn't like that. I thought, you could be like the bodhisattva of the auto world. I kind of spiced it up a little bit, but I was quite serious, really, because in that sort of a role, because you could see he was a very, very good-hearted, genuine person, and that, and he did feel he was somewhat surrounded by sharks, more kind of bottom line type business people, and that. I said, you have, just talking with you and hearing what you have to say, you have really admirable, humane values, and people are looking to you for guidance. So I said, I would suggest you give it a go and try it out and let yourself stay within the field. And to a certain degree, he did. I mean, I'm not sure whether I don't think he's a CEO now, but he did stay with it and take it on. I'm not saying it's just because what I said. But there you have someone whose their heart isn't really in it to sort of be a big hotshot executive and make piles of money. It was more like, well, what can I do within this role that is handed to me? I've inherited this. What can I do that might steer things in a good way? And so... That was a conscious choice for him to sort of pick that up and do that for a certain amount of time, and then to see what are the results that come from that. There are some people who have been monastics for some time, and then they feel like this doesn't really work for me anymore. I want to be more engaged, more active in particular areas of life, and we're totally at liberty to leave at any time. Leaving the robe, it takes about 15 seconds. It's a very, very quick ceremony.
Putting on the tie is harder.
Putting on a tie is harder, yeah. And so if the heart is no longer in it, if you really want to operate in a different mode of activity, then you can. You're not imprisoned in it. And so sometimes people go out and try... The sort of activity in the world, and it works well. Sometimes they go out and give it a try, and then they think, that didn't work, and then they come back again. Yeah. So it's a flexible system. But I don't know if that answers your question.
I can go on and on, but I'm going to give someone else a chance.
Very good. Yes, there's a question out there. Speak up. So
I have a question about attachment as it pertains to... Actually, also the previous question about the goals and maybe even ambitions. Would you suggest would be the right and proper pertains to one's goals? The goals could range from something as being philanthropic and affecting millions of lives, or it could be more selfish and serving the ego. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a big question. One of the things I feel is a great cause of mental illness and depression in society is the extremely shallow goals that most of the society and education systems project for people. So that for many people, the goal of life is a good retirement program, good health insurance, getting your kids to, if you have any, to a good college, and that's kind of it. And that's it. you know, a good retirement place, and then you die, you know. What's that worth? So that's depressing. But and I'm kind of it's a that's a sort of sweeping generalization, but it's not far off. And so it's no surprise that people are really depressed, because culturally we don't have a lot to look forward to. The goals that we have, it's like, well, I want the best for my kids, but then even what is good for the kids is a, you know, good education and a nice house to live in, and that's it. So one, in terms of goals, I feel, I mean, it's a bit of a tall order, but I feel that it's one of the really useful things that can be brought into the education system and the spiritual domain is to be much more conscious of our spiritual potential as human beings, to actually talk about sainthood. You know, that enlightenment, you know, that as a child you can look forward to not just coping or a comfortable house in a nice suburb or a cottage in the Cotswolds, you know, with cabbages and carrots in the garden and goats under the apple trees, but you can look forward to a quality of freedom and well-being for yourself, and that also your life can be a source of great blessings and benefit for many others, not just in terms of their physical well-being, but similarly helping others to find that quality of spiritual abundance. I was invited to a conference on mindfulness in Amsterdam this summer, and I already had a really packed schedule of going to like about 8 different countries in 4 months, and but then I got this invite and they said, could you talk about stream entry? And this is an academic conference about 600 psychologists and therapists, and they said, could you talk about stream entry, like the first level of enlightenment? I said, really? And they said, yeah, because I saw this book of yours, and I think this is a useful thing to talk about in terms of the development of mindfulness. So even though I had a really packed calendar, I thought, I'll do that. Because, I don't know, there's probably quite a few therapists and psychiatrists and ologists in this room, but the DSM-4, the previous edition, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, was about 1,999 and a half pages on pathologies and half a page on well-being. The DSM-5 apparently has about 150 pages, so a couple of hundred pages on well-being, but still 1,950 or 850 on pathologies. But well-being is kind of like not being sick. And so what we have in the Buddhist tradition is like the qualities of well-being are quite thoroughly articulated, and degrees of not just coping, but, you know, well-being to the point of ongoing kind of happiness and freedom and a joy-filled, a joyful life. And that's just not talked about. That kind of quality of spiritual fulfillment, and the ways that one might go about achieving that through what you do with your mind, not just how much money you have or what career you choose or who you get partnered with, but what you do with your mind moment by moment. That's just not in the curriculum. That's not in the society. So again, it's a bit of a tall order, but I really like to get that into the meme pool of society, that's possible for us. That when kids are going to school, you know, primary school, secondary school, people, college kids, people in the workplace, that this is something that is meaningful and practical to work towards, not just coping, but rather to see that as a human being, you have the potential for a kind of arching happiness and sense of peace and contentment and freedom. We can do that. We have that possibility. I was saying to some people yesterday, I think, when I was a college student, I did a psychology degree in London University, and in the I think the very first term or the first couple of terms we were there, we were doing a course on Freud, and we were one of the very early lectures that we had on Freud, the ending of his first book, The Interpretation of Dreams, I think that was his first book, he makes a statement that the best that my method can do is to transform your neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. And so I was a kind of a hairy 18-year-old, but something in my heart said, no! We can do better than that. I'm not going to settle for ordinary human unhappiness. You know, so I was ready to argue with Freud at the age of 18. So modesty was never my strong suit. But it was a very sort of intuitive lurch of the heart. Like, no, we can do better than that. But society, it doesn't look much beyond that. You know, if you can... ordinary human unhappiness without causing too much trouble, great. You know, if we can kind of get by without causing too much difficulty and too many disasters, whew. But we can do better than that. So in terms of goals, then I would say looking to that potential that we have, and then if that manifests as a lot of activity in the world that affects other people in a direct way, like, you know, creating institutions or medicines or art forms or writing the great novel creating music, or whether and that sort of affects directly the minds of millions of people, or whether it's just how you function in your own little sphere and how that the ripples go out, I'd say that's secondary. Yeah, it's not just the sort of the grand performances that make a difference. It can be just the way that you function in your own little sphere, and that can have a very powerful effect. Like Satish Kumar, who's a very highly regarded spiritual teacher, writer in the UK, isn't it? He was a Jain monk who walked from India to. He walked to all of the capitals of the nuclear powers and gave the leaders of the governments tea. It's very either Indian or English gesture. It's a encouraging world peace. Anyway, he became a spiritual teacher and very influential, very respected. And he said his major spiritual influence was his mother, who was... unable to read and write. She was a poor Rajasthani a woman, a villager, and he said most of what of the spiritual qualities that he developed he learned from his mother, and he said that as they were growing up, then two or three of his sisters, they were quite good sewers. They used to make, you know, dresses and clothes and things. And so they'd left the village and gone off to work in the local town, and so they were able to collect some money, and they said that he said how two or three of his sisters came back to the village and said, you know, said, Mom, you know, we've saved up some money and we want to get you a sewing machine, because, you know, you like to sew, we learned to sew from you, and we know that that's what you like to do best in the world. And she said, no. She said, and then he said she held up this her needle and said, this can't break down. and yes, you know, if I had a sewing machine I could make more dresses and more clothes and that would be more stuff. But she said, what's important to me is that with every stitch that I make, I'm thinking of the person that I'm making this for. I'm with the application of this stitch and this pattern and sewing on these kind of little sparkly flowers and things that go on the clothes. And she said, why would I want to make more of them if I can't pay attention to what I'm doing in the same way? And so, just one example. So she, Satish Kumar's mother, who can't even read and write, she's probably passed away by now because he's quite elderly, but there she was in her little village in Rajasthan having this major effect on the spiritual life of of everyone who's Satish Kumar affected. And so, the ripples of what we do and how we are can radiate out. So I don't feel that having a big effect has to be something that makes the cover of Time magazine or is something particularly visible. Just the way that you function, just being the guy at the gas station who is always friendly, is always helpful, never panics. That could be by being the guy at the gas station who's always there and is this sort of reliable presence. That can be a great gift to the world. I don't know if you do work in a gas station, probably not, but some very humble activity, even though it might not seem like much, just the way you do that, the way you are in that, you touch others' lives, and that's not a small thing. That can be a powerful thing. Is that enough for this evening? I think it's probably a good enough note to end on.